Housing and Health and Human Services Subcommittee on Child Welfare, April 12, 2005, 6 p.m. Hogan County Commission Chamber.
The House Subcommittee on Child Welfare to order this April 12, 2005. This evening, we have two things on the agenda. We are going to be hearing a public hearing on House Bill 2010, and then we are going to accept open comment from members of the public related in general to child welfare. And anybody is welcome to testify on that portion of our agenda. And if you haven't had a chance to already do so, I encourage you to sign up for either this bill or open testimony, and we'll make sure that staff has a sign-up sheet out there for the open testimony portion of our agenda. I want to welcome you to our hearing, and hope you have a good chance to participate this this afternoon. This subcommittee had an opportunity to go to a child welfare field office in Oregon City, just down the street, so that we could visit with child welfare workers and understand a little bit more in depth about how we operate child welfare services in Oregon. And I guess I'll tell you, since this is our first subcommittee hearing, I'll go back and say that the legislature has an intense interest in the area of child welfare and figuring out ways how we can avoid some of the tragedies that have occurred recently in the past few years. And so part of our interest on the part of this subcommittee is to spend some time to go into the field offices and visit with our personnel, visit with the Department of Human Services, and also visit with families to see what input they have to help us design a better system and make sure that we're avoiding tragedies. And so with that, I think we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2010 and go over from there. So this House Bill 2010 was brought to us by Ken Nunes, Speaker of the House, and Bernie Giusto, who is the sheriff. And Sheriff Bernie Giusto here in Multnomah County, is really a concept to provide an additional level of accountability and oversight for some of the cases that were falling through the cracks. There's a real frustration, my sense is there's a real frustration on the part of a lot of people in the legislature that we're having these tragedies and we're trying to develop systems to prevent them from occurring in the future. And this is a bill that that speaks to one concept of how to do that. So we had a public hearing in Salem on this bill about 3 weeks ago and had quite a bit of public testimony, including from the Department of Justice, where this Inspector General unit would be housed. So I'd like to invite Marlene Shipley forward. Is Marlene here? Good evening, welcome.
Hello.
I'd like to just have you start with your name.
Marlene Shipley.
Okay.
All right. And I am also representing National Family Rights Association that has come about because of the cracks that you so refer to these. We are very concerned. We just got a call the other night on this missing girl from Jefferson. Mother wasn't even notified until 9 days after she was missing. Custody of DHS. We'd like to know why children are being abused. And in the foster care system, it's being reported. Parents are being told it is retaliating. My child is here. Who was one of those kids? He will not speak on camera. If you would like to speak to him afterwards, you would like to. Our concern is Department of Justice, DHS, everybody works together. Are we using the same agency to put a Band-Aid on something that isn't actually going to work? Instead of having outside people who would know what goes on involved in this committee also to watch, to make sure that kids are not being harmed, that the proper kids are being helped, not kids whose parents have a health issue, so we're going to go and we're going to take the children. We have seen numerous ones of these. I was one of them. I had just had a surgery. All of a sudden, I couldn't take care of my children after I'd been doing it for 7 years as a single parent. Why didn't they offer me help to come into my house, help me with the children? Instead of removing them, my son, black and blue, sexually abused. He now has PTSD and panic disorder, thank you to the state of Oregon. I'm very angry. He's very angry.
How could we have done things better?
He could have approached, I was a domestic violence sexual assault advocate for 7 years before this happened. I had worked with the system. I had full faith in the system until this happened to me and I actually saw what happened. Check the stories out. Kids are out there. I know for a long time, and even as an advocate for sexual assault and domestic violence, we were taught kids don't lie. The kids have now, through the schools, learned how to manipulate the systems, to be able to, mom and dad are not giving me what I want. So I'll go to school and I'll say, I sat on my dad's lap and he was getting an erection. All of a sudden the kids are gone. Or, my mom's sick, she can't cook us dinner tonight. They didn't neglect the fact that my home, I had a 17-year-old, two 14-year-olds, and a 12-year-old. There was no reason that they weren't capable, while I was recovering from surgery, to make a meal now and then. Being told, it's against the law for my children to do chores, what are we turning out? Children who have no sense of responsibility? They get out of the job market, what are they going to do? I don't have to do anything. I'll call the police. I'll call child welfare. It's not working. Your whole system is broke. As a disabled person, I was not given any 504 rights that I should have been under federal laws. I know numerous other parents I have advocated for who were claimed by DHS as to be low IQ. Does a low IQ make you not a good parent? Help the people instead of ruining the families. As much as you think that going in and taking the kids is helping, the kids will always love their parents. They need help to stay together as a unit. Taking the kids away automatically causes PTSD. The physical abuse, the children that are running from the abuse on the streets, nobody knows where they are. I actually had this girl in my hands Saturday night. Do you know I called 911 and I was told I wasn't a priority? They didn't have any paperwork on her being a runaway from Jefferson County. Where are these things falling through? If they would have done it, the mother could have known where her daughter was. At least I could tell her her daughter was still alive Saturday night. What's happened to her since Saturday night? We have no idea. A group of my advocates went out and combed the streets for this child. We found it. DHS can't find it. The police can't find it. How can a set of advocates do it?
So did you have some specific suggestions for us?
Specifically, yes. Check the stories out there. Go into the homes and help instead of taking the children. If the family needs help, help them. You know, some of you think of an unclean house. When did it become against the law to have an unclean house? I do remember my grandmother's prayers, you know, forget about the house, forget about the dishes, the children need you now. When did that become against the law?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Next, I would like to invite, let's see, do we have a full panel? Okay, Jessica Stevens, Eric Vermeulen, Marcy Cady, and Julie LaChapelle. You want to come all the way? Okay, great. Good evening, welcome.
Good evening. Good evening, Chair Delker and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And we represent most of the frontline workers who work in our child welfare system. I wanted to speak just to a few of our questions around Hospital 2010, and then Marcy and Julie were going to talk a little bit just about the improving the system in general. Our members have met with Sheriff Justo, who requested the introduction of Hospital 2010, and we believe that we have the same end goal in mind, but aren't clear that this language is exactly worded is the best way to get there. So we had a lot of questions about the language seems pretty general, and that may be meaning that there's room for changes. One of the things that doesn't seem to be addressed in this is the role of the courts. The judges do make all the critical decisions in terms of deciding where children should be removed from homes or placed into foster care. And that's an important consideration in terms of looking at how decisions are made throughout a process. We had some concerns about what it means to enter a local office and conduct an investigation. It's unclear to us what an investigation looks like and what that would consist of. We had some concerns about Section B, about reviewing case file information. We're unclear if this meets confidentiality statutes. It's very important, and our members work very hard to make sure to protect the confidentiality of the children and the family members, and also, importantly, reporters of suspected abuse. Section 3 talks about random inspections, and again, we have questions about what that consists of and what the goals would be to come out of those inspections. The process doesn't seem to lay out conclusions or any kind of what actions the unit would take. Do they make recommendations? Do they make reports? What are the powers of the unit? So we have a lot of concerns. Certainly, folks see every day the struggles that families in Oregon are faced with, and we want to make sure that our children's safety is the number one priority. And in that process, we want to make sure that the struggles of Oregon are not all placed upon the shoulders of one particular caseworker who's trying to do the best they can in a situation where the caseloads have increased dramatically and the resources may or may not be available to them throughout the human services system. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Jewel, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
I'm sorry, Representative Gilmer, did you have a comment?
Yeah, no, I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
It could wait till later. Let me ask the question and wait till later to answer. I sat in listening in on phone calls on the hotline today, and among the things, it was a fascinating experience, and I worked with one of your wonderful members. And you raised this question of confidentiality. And one of the things that was clear to me in that conversation was that the worker in dealing with another professional, not a reporter, was trying to make sure the other professional knew what information they needed to help do their job and was dancing around some issues of confidentiality in this case. It wasn't about a reporter, it was about some issues, some dynamics in the family. Do you find confidentiality not only protects folks, but also sometimes gets in the way of your ability to do your main job, which is to protect kids? And is there something we can do about that? And why don't we hold the answer to that? That's right. Let me just put that question out for you to be thinking about this.
Thank you for your question, sir. Thank you for making time to talk to us today about improving the system. We are, Marcy and myself, along with many other workers through the state, Hi, Ms. Tanner. This is myself, it appears. I'm Julie LaChapelle. I am a social service specialist for the Department of Human Services Child Welfare. Currently, I'm in a position of non-case carrying. I don't manage a caseload. I started that in October. Before that, previously for 5 years, I managed a protective services caseload where I was a frontline assessor of child abuse. I wanted to talk a little bit about improving the system and some of the elements I see are really important to improving our system in child welfare. Like any system, we can always be improved. One of the main issues I see right now, especially in Clackamas County, as I don't have a view of other counties, we're getting really overwhelmed. The number of calls that we're getting in on a regular basis, the amount of staff we have to respond to those calls. As a member of the Protective Services Unit for 5 years, I never felt that we had the resources to remain caught up, to manage our caseloads, to the ability our clients deserve. I really felt that we could use more time, more staff, a better balance of documentation versus client contact. Currently, we hold many responsibilities to make sure that we are dotting our I's, crossing our T's, documenting our contacts, reporting to various parties at certain deadlines. And in doing so, we miss out on the real crux of social work, which is relationships with our clients. I truly believe as a social worker that the real basis of change in anybody, whether that's a person who's dealing with addiction or sexual abuse, who's dealing with poverty or neglect, is relationship. We are trying to address issues in families that have overwhelmed them to a point where they need state intervention. They don't have the resources themselves to fix these problems. Sometimes they're willing to change, and sometimes they're looking for the help. Many of the times they're in a situation where they haven't even met their basic needs in order to see that they're in need of help. The best way for us to help is to establish that relationship with clients. What motivates all of us to do anything, to make things better, to change? It's the people around us, the faith we have in each other, the care we give to each other. Relationship motivates change. Currently, we as a staff don't have the time we need to develop relationships with each of our clients that are quality enough to motivate that change. We don't have the time, we don't have the resources to get to know them, to let them to get to know us, to get to know their families, to develop the empathy and compassion that will help move them forward in whatever challenge they're trying to turn out to be good parents. Many of the times our parents have great skills. They have strengths that really can get them through. It's hard to find that out when you have to come back and write multiple reports, case notes, answer emails, do those type of things. With a manageable caseload, one could easily balance relationship and documentation. Currently, we don't have that. I am not a part of the Protective Services Unit right now, but I serve them. I work on a specialized team of addiction recovery, and every time they get a methamphetamine baby that comes in or a parent with an addiction problem, I aid them. I enhance their services. And they're overwhelmed. And they move their work on to another unit. Well, two or three units that are all overwhelmed. Nobody wants to take a new case. Nobody wants to have something else come in new because that just is taking time away from the other neglected cases they already have. I would say the majority of the workers I run into have great skills, have the ability to build relationship, create empathy, to do really good work with people. Of course, there's always people out there I have opinions that they need to improve. But I think for the most part, they really care about their clients and they're not being given the resources they need. Even under ethical standards of the National Association for Social Workers, to do a good job, to do a really good job. The love of the work is out there, the resources aren't. one of the resources that we really enjoyed in the past and has been taken away due to the budget deficits is the flex funds through the system of care. I used to be able to support my clients in many ways that help them pull themselves out of whatever challenge, whether that be addiction or homelessness. I was able to get that dumpster for the messy house so the children didn't have to go anywhere. I was able to help pay rent for those 2 months that somebody was out of work or was ill. I was able to help with addiction services so much more easily when the funds were there for me to request those type of services. We're really limited in those services right now. We're really limited in getting somebody in there to do parent training or parent coaching. The person before me speaking asked, you know, does a low IQ mean you can't parent? Well, no. But a little extra help might get you to the point where you are a good parent. You're that minimally adequate parent that we don't have to intervene upon. We don't have the money to get the parent mentors anymore. Those individualized services, those in-home services, and that's all really important. Our clients benefited from those. Some don't. That's true. Sometimes you have to move on to the next steps. But many of them do. And along the lines of reducing caseload is don't take away any more workers from us. We went through a hiring freeze in the last couple of years, right after reorganization. That was very challenging to those of us on the front line. I was explaining to represent Detective Dalton earlier today that before I changed positions due to my own personal situation, I did a ton of overtime. I was always out in the field past 7 o'clock, middle of December, rainy nights, looking at houses, trying to make contact with my clients, trying to follow up so I met deadlines. I was always here doing paperwork, preparing for a court hearing, writing a psychological referral, returning calls, because if there's one complaint you hear about us, it's returning calls. If we lose positions or even stay where we're at, that's just going to continue. Within 3 years of being hired on as a protective services worker, I was given a leadership role in my unit. Within 4 years, I was a lead worker, because that's how much turnover happened within my 9-member unit. I suddenly became the senior member. I'm not that old. I'm not that experienced. I welcomed the role, enjoyed being a leader in my unit, and trained a lot of the newer workers. But I can tell you now that there's very few workers who were even there a year ago that I worked with. There's been so much overtime. Half the unit has gone away and new workers have come in. It's hard to continue to support people to maintain that long-term relationship with their job and get the experience and do a really good job for clients if they're not feeling supported. It's the relationship with your job, though, that you have to foster instead of just the relationship with the client.
Can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
You keep talking about the client, and as a child protective worker, who's your client?
There's lots of different clients. First of all, the family. The family is your client. We protect the child, and we support the parent to reunify or to maintain that child in the home. We're also responsible to each other as workers to be supportive, to back each other up so stuff doesn't fall through the cracks. Not necessarily a client, but we serve each other. I think we serve the community, because when we're out there serving the children who live on your blocks that have problems, who are being neglected, who are not getting served the way they need to be served, we're keeping crime from being committed in your neighborhoods.
Yeah, sure, please. You're a social worker. We're talking about NASW standards.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I asked, are you a social worker? You asked about NASW standards.
Yes.
You have special professional obligations to clients, and I was wondering the extent to which your obligations to the child or the children in the family and their best interest ever get in conflict with your obligations to other clients, parents.
I think parents would be the biggest issue there, because you're looking at the self-determination of an adult compared to the protection of a child. the children being on the priority list as being the most needy and the most vulnerable usually are first priority. But we as social workers, and I don't know how many workers actually consider themselves professional social workers. I do. I find that you have to really struggle with that conflict of interest between the self-determination of your client to make choices that may or may not be in the best interest of their own child over the protection of that child as it relates to the laws and standards of the state of Oregon, which I'm really very responsible to.
Would it help you do your job if we made clear in a very specific way that your responsibility has your client's professional responsibility was to the children rather than to the parents of the children?
I'm not sure that would benefit the family as a whole and get that child what they need. As you've heard before, it doesn't matter what a parent does. A child will always love that parent, and it's our job to keep that family together. I truly do believe it's in the child's best interest, if safely possible, to keep that child with the family. If you make it very clear that the child's protection is the first priority and don't leave us an outlet in which to address the parent's issues and needs, then we're not going to be able to provide the best circumstances for that child, which is, in the majority of cases, that parent.
I can talk more about that, but I mean, Ashley Pons had he had responsibilities for her protection. And really many people would say that they transcend your responsibility to anybody else in that family, although I agree with you, if it's in her best interest to have a family together, then that's your job. But we institutionalize that question, and we just heard from a parent saying you have to be concerned about keeping families together. And then you hear others of us saying you have to make sure you're protecting that child. And what I'm looking at is whether this institutionalized conflict diminishes your ability to serve the child.
I don't believe the conflict does. I believe the resources needed to serve both of those interests is what keeps us from doing that. I think we can protect the child while supporting the family as a whole. I think
if you have lots more resources.
With resources, again, I'm sure you hear that 20 million times from people on the front line, and your question is probably, where do we come up with those? And I understand.
My question is, what are you going to do in the face of not having the extra resources? That's my question.
Over time?
Where does your responsibility lie? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, go ahead.
In prioritization, triage. That's what ends up happening. Do you have further questions regarding that?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Farr has a question.
My question is, can you quantify your success rate previous to what you say is a lack of resources?
I don't have that information. I didn't come prepared with it, so I don't think I can accurately quantify for you and represent the agency well.
Could you tell me, has the incidence of problems in the system increased since you've experienced this lack of resources?
Being a frontline worker, I don't think I have the overlying view of whether that's true, and I don't know if Marcy can answer that either, but I don't think I have a tall enough view because I kind of look up from the bottom. I know from what I see is the lack of resources make things a lot more challenging for us to feel like we're responsible in satisfying the needs of our clients.
Did you have another question?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I sort of had an issue come up today in the process of learning how you do your job, and there was a question that intrigued me about maximizing the ability of a caseworker, maximizing the caseworker's time with the child and with the family, like you suggested, versus all the know, the paperwork and all the sort of office management responsibilities, but also the court management responsibilities. And I wanted to get your impressions about the court, your interaction as, or the interactions of frontline workers in the courts, and how much of that affects your day, your agenda, your schedule for the day, and whether it might be appropriate to consider rethinking how we do that, to instead of having case workers and case managers go in to the courtroom to you know, work on behalf of the child, whether we should take a look at an emphasis of having attorneys from the Department of Justice look at getting in representing the children, so that case workers are freed up from that responsibility to focus more with the families and the kids. And you may not be prepared to answer that, but it's a question that, sort of has been coming around.
I actually have a couple of responses to that. One of the things that the Protective Services Unit has done to free up their workers from as many court responsibilities, that they designated one worker to go in and represent the agency and all the children and all the cases on the front line end. And that's a new system that they're trying over there. What I see as a risk in doing so is you are a party to a court case as a social worker without any legal representation. Currently, we go in, I've gone in, Marcy's gone in, our current court worker, Eric Vermillion, goes in, sits at the table. That either, but I don't think I have a tall enough view, because I kind of look up from the bottom. I know from what I see is the lack of resources make things a lot more challenging for us to feel like we're responsible in satisfying the needs of our clients.
Did you have another question?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, I sort of had an issue come up today in the process of learning how you do your job, and there was a question that intrigued me about maximizing the ability of a caseworker, maximizing the caseworker's time with the child and with the family, like you suggested, versus all the, you know, the paperwork and all the sort of office management responsibilities, but also the court management responsibilities. And I wanted to get your impressions about the court, your interaction as, or the interactions of frontline workers in the courts, and how much of that affects your day, your agenda, your schedule for the day, and whether it might be appropriate to consider rethinking how we do that, to instead of having case workers and case managers go in to the courtroom to you know, work on behalf of the child, whether we should take a look at an emphasis of having attorneys from the Department of Justice look at getting in representing the children, so that case workers are freed up from that responsibility to focus more with the families and the kids. And you may not be prepared to answer that, but it's a question that sort of has been coming around.
I actually have a couple of responses to that. One of the things that the Protective Services Unit has done to free up their workers from as many court responsibilities, that they designated one worker to go in and represent the agency and all the children and all the cases on the front line end. And that's a new system that they're trying over there. What I see as a risk in doing so is you are a party to a court case as a social worker without any legal representation. Currently, we go in, I've gone in, Marcy's gone in, our current court worker, Eric Vermillion, goes in, sits at the table, unrepresented, with everybody else who is a party to the case who has representation. The district attorney is there on the behalf of the county. Each parent has an attorney, and the child has an attorney. The caseworker does not. So essentially, you're making legal recommendations without representation. and it can be a very, very vulnerable place to be, very precarious. Having legal representation would not only aid caseworkers in making good decisions for the agency and for the families they're working with, but may or may not free up time. I'm not sure I can actually say how much, because as a caseworker, you would need to consult with that attorney. You may even need to be there to answer questions that attorney may not have. I do support having legal representation for caseworkers. It makes you feel vulnerable to be up there sitting at a table making legal decisions, maybe even practicing law, without representation. I did it for 5 years. It's very intimidating.
Can I ask a little bit about system issues? We had some chance to discuss that with some of the workers today. I know there's a story that says if you have to dig a hole and you have one person digging a hole, it's not handicapped, and if you put two people and they dig the hole and then you put four people into the hole, and pretty soon you're losing efficiency. The nth person goes into the hole and it slows the job down rather than increasing the job. What I mean about the enormous complexity of a single case and the issue that sometimes you may need to get 15 people in the room to deal with a single case, I wonder the extent to which the whole thing is organized correctly, whether there's just not, because of the complexity of the cases, creating so much specialization of function that you can't do anything without having 10 people signing off. And wonder whether there wasn't some way that you could reorganize work to make it both more satisfying. I mean, you lose 50% of your staff in a year, you're not creating a very satisfying situation. And what I know about total quality management is you get the stakeholders in the room to talk about how to make their life more efficient and more effective. I'm sure you had some ideas about the whole question of increased specialization or more generalization or trying to find some way to reorganize work. Will you share with us some of the fantasies you had about how work might be organized?
I think I mostly fantasize about having enough time to make those meetings with those other 15 people. I currently work on a family drug court team which has just about 15 people on it and a very limited amount of caseloads. We're very restrictive about who we take into this. They have to show a very high level of engagement and commitment to our program, and so we have a pretty limited number. And there are 15 of us on the team, including judges, attorneys, CASAs, drug and alcohol providers, treatment providers, family support people. We even have somebody from 12-step programs come in and mentor our clients. And we make time every week to sit down as a group and go over each client and each family, and I think that it's the time to do it.
You see three families in a week at that time, and you've got one FTE type.
We actually see 8 to 10.
That's
8 to 10 families.
Three FTEs tied up in just those 8 to 10 cases.
Yeah, and we go in and we talk about each case. From what I've seen, because I'm new to that program since October, is those clients feel more connected to each of those members of the team. They feel more successful. Representative Dalto got to meet one of them today. They feel more open and held accountable about their issues, and I think it's the time. A lot of times we use the term herding cats when trying to get together to communicate about our families. There's always a number of stakeholders in a case, whether that's a provider contracted out by the agency, an attorney general, a caseworker, a person who supervises visitation, which we call an SSA. It's finding the time and the resources, which means having enough people to do the work. We can't get a person who supervises visitation to be on that team because
they
don't
have time. Your point is that your resources are short. If you tie up 15 people for 8 hours, you've got 120. You've got three FTEs tied up for a week in those 8 patients. And is that the most efficient use? I mean, you're not going to get 3 more FTEs. So the question is that the most efficient way to use 3 FTEs?
You're speaking of efficiency.
I'm speaking of effectiveness.
Effectiveness.
I'm talking about the amount of resources per output unit, which is effectiveness, not for...
I think effectiveness is sometimes in conflict with good casework and good relationship and service to your clients. I think that if the more effective that we try to be by limiting the number of players or limiting the number of the amount of time we have to really consult with each other, communicate, and get a good view of the family, the less effective we're probably going to be. And I think that's the balance that we hold daily, is what to hold on to and what to let go of.
Hi, I'm Marcia Cady, and I'm also a social service specialist. I've actually been doing this work now for 10 years, and prior to doing CHOPTIC services, which Julie had mentioned already, I was carrying a permanency and ongoing caseload, and I had done that for approximately 7.5 years, and now I've been with the Protective Service Unit for about 2.5 years. I had chosen to move on to Protective Services because I wanted to have a new challenge and just see what doing the front-end work had been like, because it was always one of those things that you sit back and you just see so much going on and so much transition happening on a continual basis. It was just amazing to me. I think at this time, I would safely say that throughout our office at this point, I'm probably one of the most senior workers throughout our whole branch, just given that I've been there for 10 years. When I first hired on, at that point, you never saw any movement in the Clackamas branch, and actually oftentimes throughout the state, because people came to work for DHS with this idea of making that a professional career, and they would stay there for a long period of time. As time has evolved with the increased caseloads and the various changes within the system of the agency, it has made it to where people become, you know, burned out or just frustrated with these expectations that are placed on us and the responsibilities, and not feeling as though we're able to do the type of work that we wanted to be able to do, and the reasons why we came into this work to begin with, which was to work with families and to help families to get past the problems that oftentimes was the result of, be it generational poverty or addictions that they've been dealing with for a number of years, and various barriers that have resulted in our agency's intervention. When I go out and do assessments, which I couldn't begin to tell you how many I've done, you know, in the time that I've been doing child abuse investigations, but I oftentimes try to approach my families with the utmost of respect and recognizing that they're not choosing, obviously, for us to be involved in their lives, but the circumstances that have brought them to our attention and necessitate our intervention, and perhaps the children not being able to remain safely in their care for a period of time. But again, I just want to stress that I always try to encourage my parents to look at this as an opportunity to have some supportive services made available to them that oftentimes the general public aren't even aware of is available to them. I can't tell you how many times I've had families not even be aware of just community resources that you and I might be very much aware of are available, but unfortunately, due to be it isolation, whether they live in a rural area or not having the ability of which to get out and, you know, meet with other service providers or have resources made available, that they are slipping through the cracks, and hence they come to our awareness. I see my responsibility at trying to help them to understand and to educate them around what some of those resources are and to provide them with the opportunity to be successful. I know that there was a question that had been posed to Julie just a little bit ago regarding whether or not we should be looking at focusing more of our energy towards working with just the children and not focusing on the families. And I was around, I came on just right when the agency's name change occurred from Children's Services Division to Services to Children and Families. And for those of you that may have been a part of working with the state of Oregon at that time, you remember the reasons why that occurred, and that was because it was desired that we were servicing families and not just servicing the children's needs. But ultimately, the goal of our agency is to make sure that children are safe and, you know, they have the protection of our agency. Ultimately, children, no matter what has occurred in their home, they desire to be with their parents. And I feel a strong responsibility to try to do everything I can while I have a case in my caseload to try to provide whatever type of supportive services and resources to those families to help them to be successful and to overcome those barriers that have necessitated our involvement.
Can you talk about your caseload a little bit? Sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to get a sense of how many ongoing cases you're working with, how many families you're working with, what that looks like.
Well, in essence, we're not really supposed to carry cases past 30 to 45 days. The ideal is for us to be able to have the time in which to try to move cases on to a permanency worker, and then they be the ones then to further engage the family members, the parents, and the children in the services that are appropriate to help them to be successful. Unfortunately, just as today, I had two cases that I was scheduled to meet with our CETs and try to transfer those cases on to permanency workers. And unfortunately, they are the, I thought they might have been a part of the last meeting that you were involved with. They are consultants, educators, and trainers. There's, we have four CETs in our office, and they do a fabulous job in helping try to support us and getting cases transferred on as soon as possible. But it also necessitates, requires us, I should say, to have them ready for transfer, and that is to have our 307 written up, to have another document that is required to be written up that speaks to the family history and the reasons for the agency's involvement, speaks to what the children's needs are, the family strengths, you know, addition to other additional information that the permanency worker is going to benefit from having. That is, of course, in addition to whatever types of services that we are going to try to put into place, which requires, of course, referrals and of course, part of that is going to come about from meeting with families and identifying what types of supportive services are they going to benefit from without overloading them with too much to where we're going to set them up for failure. When we speak about caseloads at this time, it's not necessarily a good time because, unfortunately, we've been inundated with a lot of referrals over the last several months, and we've been short-staffed due to people moving on to other positions. So at this point, I actually have a larger caseload than I would care to. I've got five families that I'm working with, which, if I count up the number of children in substitute care at this point, I believe it comes to 9, which is a lot for a protective service worker, because with that, I feel a responsibility to be trying to get out and get to know those children the best that I can, and also get to know their family members, primarily, of course, the parents, but you know, also other family members that may be able to support the parents in being successful in the services that I'm going to provide. It is concerning to me because, of course, in the meantime, I'm continuing to get new assessments. Today I've gotten 3 that I need to get out on this week. And in order to do that, like Julie had mentioned, oftentimes I'm working longer hours. I was at the office this morning at 5:30, and if I hadn't come over here, I probably would have worked until 7:30. And that's not, you know, unlike me. Oftentimes what happens for us is we end up sacrificing ourselves and sometimes our own families as a result of the responsibility, and you feel very conscientious about what you want to be able to do to try to support the families that you're working with. I think, in comparison to that too, one thing I'll mention that Drew made note of here is for a PS worker, like I said, we try to move cases on quickly to the permanency workers because they're better equipped to be able to work with the families easier than we are because of the number of referrals that we're continuing to get and those assessments, which I would assume you may have gotten some information about what that might look like. It may be that I go out on an assessment and I may be able to have that determination made within 4 or 5 hours, or it may take me a couple of days to make the contacts to know, is it safe for the child to remain in the home? Does the family need voluntary services? Or is it going to be a case that I can just assess out and pass it on to my supervisor for review at that point? A permanency caseworker, though, on the other hand, of that typically carries anywhere from 20 to 30 cases, which may result in 45 to 60 kids on a caseload, which is a tremendous amount of families to have a responsibility for. I remember when I was doing permanency and I did everything from working with adolescents and teenagers that might be in residential care to children that were going to be freed for adoption because unfortunately they weren't able to be safely reunited with their parent. That requires, of course, a lot of work in and of itself, recruiting for appropriate families for adoptive placement if they're not going to be adopted by a family member or a current care provider, which might be a foster parent. So with that, I also wanted to look at, there was mention of a court worker that we have in place. That was a position that we as a unit had made the decision that it might help us out if we just had one person designated to work with our Clackamas County Juvenile Court, and that being Eric Vermillion. He worked as an example as to how busy we've been over this last couple of months. Last month he put in an excessive amount of overtime, and that was unfortunately at the expense of his own wife and three children that he has at home. The hope is that that's going to get better with time, but unfortunately due in part to the number of cases that have come to our agency's attention, the number of phone calls that our screeners are taking on any given day and any given month, which I would assume you've been given those numbers. I know I've spoken of those before in trainings, but I don't want to be redundant.
But 30,000 a year through the system?
That would be correct. And on any given day in Clackamas County, we average approximately 350 children in foster care, and that's not including some of the children we might have in residential care throughout the state of Oregon. So our court worker has played a very important role in being able to take care of doing our child protective custody reports or affidavits for protective custody, as well as doing all our other court proceedings. He has a good working relationship as well with the various attorneys as well as the judge. We actually had the good fortune of being able to have Judge Darling come and meet with our unit this morning and speak about, you know, things that are working, what she would like to see maybe differently, and I think that's been very beneficial. But like Julie had mentioned earlier too, at any given time, and I've been there on many occasions where I go into a court hearing, and this is more so when I was a permanency worker, but we are feeling as though we're representing ourselves and we're having to answer questions, be it by Judge Darling or whichever judge we may be before, as well as the attorneys that, you know, bring you very close to feeling like you're having to speak from legal, you know, respects. And that's not what our background is, because we're social workers, and I know Judge Darling knows that, but unfortunately we just don't have the benefit of having legal representation at those proceedings. So that part would be beneficial, I could see. There are occasions when we can seek permission if we feel as though we have a court hearing and we can ask if we can have one of the AGs come and assist us, but those are very few and far between that we have that assistance.
So let me ask you about the measure under consideration, House Bill 2010. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to take a look at it closely, and this is to either Julie or Mashi or Jessica, I suppose. The interest in this bill is to have an additional set of eyes taking a look at some of these cases. How do you perceive that would work? Do you think that is valuable? Do you disagree with that concept? Do you think that's something that could be better accomplished within the Department of Human Services internally? What are your thoughts on the specific bill?
Well, I can speak to that briefly, and if Julie would like to. I guess one thought that comes to my mind is I agree with Julie regarding confidentiality piece, and I think she had intended on perhaps addressing that perhaps a little further, but we do have, of course, regular reviews with the courts to make sure that we are indeed in compliance, and our court is very, she follows that very closely. She hasn't cut us any slack, I should say, so she makes sure that we are indeed doing what we have a responsibility to do, and that is to provide services and to support reunification, because ultimately that's what our primary goal is to support children being able to be safely returned to their parents.
Who's she?
Again, when I say she, I'm just used to referring to Judge Darling, because, and that is a female, her name is Judge Deanne Darling. So 90% of the time our court hearings are before her. Occasionally we'll have another one of the circuit court judges come up and hear the hearings.
But you have a specialist family court, I guess, here in Clackamas County. Okay.
Yes, we do, which I think has been beneficial in that she becomes very familiar with the family. So when they come in for those reviews every 3 months or every 6 months, she knows the parents and she knows the children that we're talking about. And we provide her with a lot of information so that she can feel very well informed and can make good decisions from the bench and perhaps give us some feedback as to things that she thinks the family might benefit from as well. In addition to those reviews that we have before the court is also the Citizens Review Board, which is yet another set of eyes that is, checking on the work that we're doing and how the families are doing, and I think that that's beneficial. I guess a concern that I might have would be if you have yet another set of eyes, reviewing the information, would be, is that going to perhaps make things more, you have all these different opinions, and just as an individual that may have an injury, this may not be a very good example, but individual that may have an injury and they may want to get may have been recommended for surgery and they may want to get a consultation with another doctor, a doctor's opinion may vary. So they may seek a third consult, and you could end up with three different opinions or perspectives. And so at what point do you continue to look for that input? Whereas I feel as though the agency has over time, in the 10 years I've been there, have certainly put into place, I think, a lot of checks and balances, and that's not only with the training that I'm expected to do, and we do it on a regular basis. We're expected to attend trainings that keep our skills updated and to keep us informed, and we also have, of course, our supervisors that are available that we staff with regularly, because clearly it's not just an individual's decision to decide what's going to be appropriate for the family members. There's also the CETs that they're available for us to consult with and get guidance from. So I'm not sure if I thoroughly answered that, and again, Julie might have some additional information she might want to speak to.
On the issue of confidentiality is what I'd like to speak to. Much of the information our clients are working on, the issues in which we are working on with them, is highly protected information. Recently, HIPAA has tightened down quite a bit on mental health and drug and alcohol and medical information. Very rarely does a case come to us that doesn't have some element of either drug and alcohol treatment or mental health issues or health issues. That information is highly protected by federal law, and highly regarded as personal and private by our agency. In order to respect the client's privacy, having somebody come in under a bill such as House Bill 210 to be able to just review the case file, look at that private information, whether it relates to an investigation regarding child safety or not, feels like we're not possibly following that federal law, not respecting the client's rights to privacy, a number of things. Even at this stage, when I'm asked to testify outside of a juvenile case, whether that be a child custody case or a criminal case, I'm required to have a judge review in camera any part of my case file that has been requested by or subpoenaed by an attorney before I even submit it to an attorney. Due to confidentiality laws, and that judge determines whether that information is even applicable to the case at hand. We try very hard to keep our clients' issues private, and it feels very intrusive to just allow somebody to come in and look at that information.
Of the opinion that nobody really should be able to look at their files or review those files except the caseworkers that are directly working on them?
Not necessarily. I just think there needs to be some more specific language about how that's done, what information is being looked at. Currently, we even have a mandatory reporting law that protects people who are reporting to us, who are mandated by law to report to us.
We're mandated.
Exactly.
and keeping that information, like being able to have some specific language about what information is protected and not a part of that review, and how it applies to an investigation would be what I'd like to see out of any kind of investigation of our services. I truly believe we need oversight. When we're human beings, we're going to make mistakes, and we need input on how we improve.
How should that oversight be conducted?
Well, currently, it's, as Marcy said, it's conducted through a citizen review board, in which a number of citizens review confidential information, sit with us at a table with all the attorneys and party to the case of everybody who would sit in a court review except for the judge, and review that information. They are very critical of our work. They do give us suggestions, and they give us a lot of oversight. And that's not just on cases where we're court involved. That's in court cases where we have intervened to the level where children are outside of the home for any reason, whether a parent has voluntarily placed them or we have chosen to legally intervene. We're also given feedback and oversight by court-appointed special advocates who are advocating for the rights of the children. When any time they are appointed to a case, they're looking at our work, they're making suggestions, they're looking at what we do, and they're more than willing usually to share that information with either the court or the citizen review board. And then we have our regular court reviews, which are reviewed on a regular basis, usually by Judge Darling, as Marcy has said, and once we come to a case where reunification can't happen, all of our work is going to be reviewed by another judge who is going to look at a termination of parental rights hearing. And we're going to be overseen by that in our work as well.
So with those systems in place, where do you see these children falling through the cracks?
At risk of beating a dead horse, like not having caseworkers who have enough time and resources to serve them fully. I don't feel comfortable really addressing some of the cases that have been brought up, such as Pond, some of the work we did last December. I just feel that the more I look critically at my work and the work of my coworkers, I think that that's what we're missing, is resources. And I think we're missing time resources, and I think we're missing service or product resources.
Could you try to comment on that? We are living in the world we're living in, and the world we're living in means there are not going to be a lot of more resources into this area in the near term. And there's not going to be a lot more resources into K-12, and there's not going to be a lot more resources into higher ed. So, we're going to simply have to figure out how to do a better job of what we have. And that's what our quest is, not to find bad people, not to point fingers, but to try and look for ways that we are not going to double the resources. We're not going to add 25% resources. If we can hold our own over the next biennium or two, some of us are going to breathe a sigh of relief.
Fully. I don't feel comfortable really addressing some of the cases that have been brought up, such as Pond, some of the work we did last December. I just feel that the more I look critically at my work and the work of my coworkers, I think that that's what we're missing, is resources. And I think we're missing time resources. And I think we're missing service or product resources.
Could you try to comment on that? We are living in the world we're living in, and the world we're living in means there are not going to be a lot of more resources into this area in the near term. And there's not going to be a lot more resources into K-12, and there's not going to be a lot more resources into higher ed. So, we're going to simply have to figure out how to do a better job with what we have. And that's what our quest is, not to find bad people, not to point fingers, but to try and look for ways that we can we are not going to double the resources. We're not going to add 25% resources. If we can hold our own over the next biennium or two, some of us are going to breathe a sigh of relief. So that answer might be absolutely 100%, 1,000% right. It's just not very helpful, because that's not going to happen.
I think what might be helpful is continuing to have committees like yours looking at what we're doing. I was grateful because I had asked representatives before to come out with me in the field. I had asked them to consider coming to floors with me and to submit themselves to possible life. We talked about some of the risks I take on a daily basis. I think by having...
And you may be sure those risks are with our staff.
I mean,
they're
sure
community, because I know, but they don't.
Okay. I think it was a door. I was asked to enter, I asked to enter somebody's apartment. They gave me full permission. As I stepped in, she hit me with the door and shoved me backwards. I have had dogs, weather. We do go up on the mountain and have to face the snow without appropriate vehicles. We go into methamphetamine labs. I myself have had to be decontaminated from entering the methamphetamine lab unknowingly. We are confronted with people who are high, and even though they may be intelligent, capable, good parents when they're clean and sober, they can be very scary when they're high. We have to deal with the hazards of a dirty house. And when I talk about dirty house, my standards for cleanliness are rather low. I'll be honest with you, that's personal and professional. I do not need spick and span. I'm not a white glove person. You have to have something unsafe in that house to make it a quote-unquote dirty house for me. You have to have glass shards. You have to have hypodermic needles. You have to have access to controlled substances, methamphetamine, pot, pipes, needles, firearms, which we are confronted with at times. I was sharing with Representative Delco that we aren't allowed to carry anything to protect ourselves. I wouldn't want to be in a position to need to use anything. The most I'm allowed to carry is a flashlight. This helps with the dogs, which especially in rural Clackamas County is a huge issue for us. We drove up to a house today in which I have been to numerous times before, and an unknown dog who was at the car, and I was just like, wonder what's going to happen with that dog. I've been confronted with Siberian tigers, cougars, wolves, and some sort of African cat that I don't recall the name of. I've been confronted with lice and scabies. I've never contracted it, funny enough, though. There's all sorts of bloodborne pathogens that we are confronted with, staph infections, other illnesses that we're not aware of. I mean, somebody's not going to come up to me, shake my hand, and say, hi, I have flea. Every night you come home with the possibility of these things to bring to your family. I know we've had staff members who brought those home to their entire family. It feels a little different than when your second grader brings it home because, you know, she was sharing the comb with the girl at the table next to her. We face a lot of these risks, and having people in there looking at those and seeing those and being empathetic is helpful. I think we can improve our work in lots of ways. Of course, I'm going to keep trading on the resources, but I also think having support from the legislature, not pointing fingers, really working with workers to improve their skills rather than crucifying somebody, is going to help. We face a lot of things out there that law enforcement faces. We're not wearing bulletproof vests. We're not wearing bunny suits. We're not given the same tools they have to protect themselves, but we are an enforcer of a particular law. We are law enforcement in some ways, and we put ourselves out there. We deserve the support to do that. I'm younger, I'm smaller, and not always taken as very scary, but I try. And so it can be a very vulnerable place to be in. I led the whole protective service unit that Marcy was in under those conditions.
Hasn't the legislature taken you up on Liberty Forest?
No, and I have asked. I asked a representative from Salem to come with me.
Oh, my God.
And I also followed up twice with that person, inviting them to come with me. And there's a whole different perspective when you're sitting on a floor of dirty underwear and burning mattresses and broken children's toys and food debris, which you bring home with you.
President Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie, I know that we all agree that you have a very difficult job, and we applaud your efforts. And this House bill and this oversight is not meant to trip you up. The goal is just to add another piece that will keep children safe. And so what I'm wondering, what I'd like you to answer for me is, in the past, the Citizens Review Board obviously hasn't been enough. What kind, if you don't like the oversight that is represented in this bill, what could you recommend to us?
I'm not sure I communicated that I didn't like the oversight represented in this bill. As we've heard before, it's the specific language. It leaves it very open to interpretation. Communication is a big issue around dealing with families. And if there's not specifics written in the language about how this is going to happen and under what conditions this is going to happen, it allows people who are investigating this to work in an inconsistent and general manner in which they take a lot of liberties with how that's going to do. We're not allowed to do that in the way we deal with clients. We have to follow the ORS that you guys put together for us. We have to follow strict confidentiality, strict follow-up, timeline, deadlines, and the language is very vague.
And a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it's just the language that you have an issue with, then how would you feel about being part of the process to develop language that you could be comfortable with? But would still allow oversight and, with the ultimate goal of adding another layer to be sure that we're keeping children safe.
If I was able to continue to serve my clients at the level I was able to serve my clients now, have time with my family, get a full night's sleep, eat good meals, and take care of myself while doing that, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Well, I'm not asking you to write legislation.
No, I understand that, but participating in anything outside of my regular routine takes away from my addiction recovery clients. And if I take time away from them there, I usually feel like making it up someplace else, and I don't come home on time. I don't take care of myself to some level. My husband has already had disagreements with my level of participation in protective services, and that's why I'm not doing an addiction recovery position.
Well, Julie, I think the point of my question was, I wasn't necessarily directing it at you, but Jessica, would you like to?
Yes, I can speak to that with Chair Delta Representative Farr. We absolutely have expressed interest in talking more on this issue and would be happy to look at language alternatives or come up with other solutions. We absolutely are looking for support in the system so that there is a better understanding of the work that's done and the risks that children face, and a lot of that being due to the lack of resources. So we're very interested, whether it's specifically Julie or a group of workers from around the state, to look at language and help figure out what the appropriate mechanism or system would be to continue to provide support to child welfare workers.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Just make one clarification regarding the discussion around conflict of interest and the definition of clients. The goal may be to safely reunite families, but I put the emphasis on safe, and that while reunification in those situations is the ideal outcome for families, if there's a question of the children's safety,
that becomes the priority. The reunification is not a priority if the child's safety is in question, and I just wanted to clarify that for the record.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that too, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we're looking for ways to help, and if there's confusion between those, and we've heard confusion in the hearings that you've been in, the one thing that will make clear is that your absolute 100% total primary responsibility is the safety and well-being of the child. Now, then I think if we need to make that clear, then we need to find a way to make that clear in statute or in rule or something else. Then, I agree, the best interest of the child is generally to be with the family, but if there's any conflict, and there is conflict, between I want my kid back, you stole my kid from me, I get a lot of letters like that, you stole my kid from me and you're bad, my answer is you have to protect that child first, is my belief, and that may be an issue we need to take up in committee.
Chair Alper, Representative Green, my understanding of how members approach cases at this point is very much so to prioritize the child's safety, that our folks do work beyond that, but that the number one priority is the child's safety.
Okay.
That is fair.
Okay. Actually, I had one other question that I didn't get a chance to ask, and that was, Jerry, you made the point about the judges being very familiar with some of the families because they were seeing them over and over again in front of family court. Are these families that you're dealing with generally the same families over time or intergenerationally, or just, you know, I mean, are there a lot of new families coming in the system, or is it just folks that we know have ongoing problems?
I think Marcy actually commented on the judge seeing the families over and over again. She had looking to say about it. We talked a little bit earlier about there being quite a bit of intergenerational poverty, drug addiction. We do see lines of families come through on a regular basis. I think also, especially regarding drug and alcohol issues, we see a lot of new families coming through as well.
But are they mostly the same families?
I'm not sure. It's a very hard question to answer. I'm not sure I have an answer that's supported with any sort of actual facts, and I don't want to misrepresent. Most of my information is anecdotal around that.
Okay.
All right.
Representative Dollar, if you don't mind if I speak to that, I know that I asked the question of Judge Darling this morning when she was at our meeting regarding if she has seen many of the children coming before her. She also oversees our juvenile delinquency hearings as well, and I asked her, are you seeing many children, or I should say teenagers, coming through your court system that we had seen on a dependency case perhaps, you know, 5-10 years earlier? And she said actually she had seen that number decrease considerably. She's been, I believe, on the Clackamas County bench now for almost 9 years, and she indicated she's seen it decrease, which I found to be hopeful. As far as new referrals that we get on families that we've seen before, we will have those that will occur, because unfortunately we're not always able to be successful, and or a mother may have her parental rights terminated and she may have another child with another partner, or whatever the case may be. There may be another reason that comes up, you know, in the future that necessitates our involvement. But again, I echo Julie's sentiments around, I feel as though we could do, you know, even a better job than we all, each of us, strive to do, you know, be able to reduce our caseloads and be able to spend more time in getting to know the children and getting to know the families that we're working with. And that would, you know, help us to help them to be more successful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to each and every one of you. Thanks for everything that you guys do to protect kids in this state. This is the first meeting that we're having of this committee. We have another meeting scheduled in Gresham on Thursday. We'll have another public hearing at that time and see if more families will come and share their personal stories with us, and then we're going to go back to Salem after that and hold some additional hearings. So these we're doing sort of ongoing work on this bill and other bills, and I appreciate your participation in that. Okay. All right, with that, we'll adjourn the meeting. We'll adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2010 and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.